Finally this hour, a reporter who usually brings us the latest from Broadway is going to get personal. Jeff London does some performing of his own. He's in a classical music group called the Desoff Choirs. Last month, the group was invited to back up a legendary rock star, Ray Davis of the Kinks. Jeff London had such a good time, he had to tell us about it.
I started singing in choirs when I was a kid. So did Ray Davis.
I went to school in Muswell Hill. It was a Church of England school, and the headmaster was also the choir master in the local church. So it was obligatory. We rehearsed at school, and I took to it because we'd get a few lessons off because we sang in the choir. We missed maths.
And that is where the similarity ends. When I sing, I'm just one of dozens of voices in an amateur group. When he sings, he's the voice of one of the most influential rock bands of the 1960s.
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing.
So in my choir, which has sung classical music at Lincoln Center in Carnegie Hall, got the call to sing classic Kink songs with Ray Davis, I thought, wow.
You got me so
and let me tell you, it turned out to be a blast. We were singing arrangements from his new album called The Kinks Choral Collection, which is a collaboration between Davis and the Crouch End Festival Chorus in London. David Temple, who conducts that choir and conducted us, says Ray Davis came to hear his group sing a few years ago.
We went to the pub afterwards, and he said, look, I've just been asked to do the Electric Proms for the BBC, and they say you have to have something different to what you normally do, so I've got this idea of having the choir there as well.
It went so well, they decided to record this album. Which spans 45 years of Davis's career, including some of his hits and some of his lesser-known songs.
The Village Green is a little-known Kinks album. Well, it's very well-known among Kinks fans, but to the rest of the world it's virtually unknown. It's a strange album I did about England, about a community of kind of mystery and fantasy.
We are the Custom Pie Appreciation Consortium. God save the George Cross and all those who were awarded him.
One of the most enjoyable arrangements to sing from that album, for me anyway, was Picture Book, which features some of Davis's most sardonic lyrics and where the chorus sings a lot of the band's instrumental licks and backup vocals.
Picture yourself when you're getting off.
When the choir I sing in performs classical music, we don't get audience feedback until the end of a piece, which can be at the end of a concert. But in Town Hall, in front of 1,000 rabid Ray Davis fans who know every word of every song, we got feedback immediately.
Two of the moments in the show that I find really rewarding are the two times the choir and the audience sing together.
Whenever I gaze on Waterloo sunset, I am in paradise. Big shout out.
Perhaps the boldest choral arrangement on the album, and one of the most striking moments in concert, is the Kinks' 1965 single, See My Friends. There's no band, just a cappella chorus and Ray Davis.
See my friends.
Davis says, for an old rocker, it's nice to revisit his old friends.
See My Friends, for example, was a seemingly very simple pop record, but it's evolved into something. It's a relief that the songs have withstood the test of being transcribed and put into this context.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London, still basking in my 15 minutes of rock fame.
She is gone, and now there's no one else.
And if you want to listen to a few more minutes of Ray Davis with the Desoff Choirs, you can hear a live performance at nprmusic.org.
Set my friend.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Graham Smith. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes. The staff includes Jonathan Baer, Art Silverman, Rob Ballinger, Melissa Gray, Brendan Banizak, Shireen Meraji, Sonari Glinton, and Bilal Qureshi.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The river.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. This week and next, we're looking at changes to the music industry over the past decade. Today, we go back to 2002, the year Fox Television unveiled a talent competition. Maybe you love it, maybe you hate it, but American Idol has become a force in popular music. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music has these reflections.
American Idol wasn't the first TV show to make a pop star, and it hasn't been the last. Just this year, America's top-selling album came from the runner-up on Britain's Got Talent, 48-year-old Susan Boyle.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by.
Remember Star Search in the 80s? You voted for the winner by phone, from the comfort of your couch. American Idol not only has viewers and callers, but emotionally invested participants, superfans with power dialing software, email accounts, even internet message boards. A few years after it started, American Idol pushed the idea of audience participation even further by letting one lucky fan write the show-stopping ballad that would close out the season. The songs they used in the first few seasons were always horrible, some piece of mawkish flotsam about dreaming big, climbing mountains, and rhyming believe with achieve. Here's the first winner, Kelly Clarkson, in 2002.
Oh, I can't believe it's happening to me. Some people wait a lifetime for a moment like this.
Now, I have no musical aspirations myself, no desire or talent to become a pop star or a songwriter. But when they announced that they'd let a viewer write the big ballad, I immediately began sketching out what I believed to be the perfect American Idol song. I wanted something vaguely patriotic and sort of religious, and I wanted to capture the way a very uncomplicated pop singer might feel at the conclusion of an unlikely journey. My song was called On the Wings of Dreaming Eagles, and it may be the worst song ever written by a human being.
Now I can fly in the sky on the wings of dreaming eagles, 'cause I believe in myself. I know that miracles are real.
I never actually submitted On the Wings of Dreaming Eagles. I couldn't get past the fear that it would win, and that 40 million people would one day remember who I was and why. American Idol is about to enter its 9th season. 3 months from now, the most famous person on the internet will be someone no one has heard of today. It may be a plucky dreamer from the wrong side of the tracks, or a grizzled veteran of talent camps who's dreamed of stardom since birth. Some of us will hate this person with a sick fury, Others will paint his or her name on poster board using glitter. In any case, 8 years later, the return of American Idol means that a few more stars are about to be born, whether we watch or not. And in May, by the time it's all over, those stars will bask in the embrace of a divided nation, secure in the knowledge that, because they believed in themselves, they know that miracles are real.
Stephen Thompson is an editor for NPR Music. As part of our coverage of music in the past decade, we challenged our online audience to write and record a song in just one weekend. More than 150 people sent us songs. You can hear them all at nprmusic.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The iPod wasn't the first player to offer music on the go, remember the Walkman, and it wasn't the first portable MP3 player. But it did revolutionize the way people consume music. As we look back at the signal events of this decade, NPR's Laura Seidel revisits 2001 and the launch of the iPod.
Steve Jobs, founder of Apple, stood in front of a San Francisco audience wearing his trademark jeans and black turtleneck and asked a question.
How many times have you gone on the road with a CD player and said, oh God, the CD, I didn't bring the CD I wanted to listen to? To have your whole music library with you at all times is a quantum leap in listening to music.
Apple launched the product with a series of characteristically savvy commercials. A geeky guy gets jazzed up to go out and dances around his apartment listening to his iPod.
iPod, 1,000 songs in your pocket.
The player was about the size of a deck of cards, and like other Apple products, it looked cool. It was also easy to use. It had a white wheel on the front that let you scan quickly through the stored music library. But it wasn't just the player that was so revolutionary. It was the software.
We don't really understand now what a shock it was when it came out.
Sandy Perlman is a record producer who's worked with Blue Oyster Cult and The Clash, among others. He was also a founder of eMusic, one of the earliest legal download sites. Perlman says the iPod, combined with the iTunes software, created the first complete web-connected portable music system.
One of the most salient proofs of concept that it demonstrated was that you could use the internet on a seamless, really easy-to-use, like falling off a lubricated log basis.
And iTunes offered access to music from the major record labels. Up until that time, no company had succeeded in getting them to come together and be part of an online music site. But as a growing number of customers began to download music without paying, the industry realized it needed to offer a legal alternative. Don Passman is an entertainment attorney who's represented REM and Janet Jackson.
So when iTunes or an iPod came along and wanted to put money into legitimately selling music digitally and put advertising and marketing behind it, the industry was very excited to see that there was someone there that wanted to do something legal.
Despite its steep initial price and problems with its batteries, the iPod took off, selling more than 225 million units to date. Now, when a candidate runs for office, they better prepare themselves for the inevitable question.
Tonight, we will be focusing on Barack Obama and John McCain, the Democratic and Republican candidates for President of the United States. But more importantly, we'll be focusing on their iPod playlists.
When President Obama met the Queen of England, he gave her an iPod. But 8 years after its launch, this one included videos and photos. Now there's the iPod Touch and the iPhone, which can connect directly to the internet. And that just may make the regular old iPod as obsolete as the Walkman. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And all this week and next, we're exploring the decade in music on our website. You can see a timeline of major events and hear the music at nprmusic.org.
When it comes to pop music, it was a good year for the Black Eyed Peas, Beyonce, and Lady Gaga. They dominated the charts. But our pop music critic, Maura Johnston, is more interested in the pop songs that didn't own the Billboard charts, the overlooked songs of the year. And Maura is in our New York studio. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Let's start with your first pick.
Why Are You the One?
The song is called Why Are You by a singer named Amory.
Well, I'm asking you.
So this is a song that I really, really loved from the first moment that I heard it over the summer. And I actually, you know, I was here probably a couple of months ago lobbying for this to be the song of the summer.
I remember.
But it lost out to the Black Eyed Peas.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is off of Amory's album In Love and War, which came out last month. And, you know, she's had sort of a rough go of it with the industry. Her record before this, Because I Love It, actually never came out in the States, even though it had some really great singles on it. You know, she's just always put out these really sort of smart, quality R&B songs, and she has a lot of heart in them, and it's just, it's a shame that, you know, it's not more successful than it is.
Okay, Maura, let's move on to something different. What else you got for us?
The next song is by the band Fall Out Boy, and it is their single called America's Sweethearts. Let's hear it for America's sweethearts, but I must confess, I'm in love with my own sins. So this is a song that's sort of, you know, an anomaly on radio, I think, today, which is the sort of big, huge pop rock song with soaring choruses, and it actually, I think, has a really great counterpart guitar line, which I only discovered, actually, when I was playing a video game that the band had put out earlier this year that was based on the old computer game Oregon Trail. And it has all these sort of different components where instead of being on the Oregon Trail in the 19th century, you're on tour with the band. And when you stop in certain cities, you have to play sort of like a Guitar Hero type game. And you actually learn the sort of counter melody while you're playing. And I don't know, it endeared me to the song. I actually loaned it to a couple of friends, and they were like, oh, these songs are so great.
You can bow and pretend that you don't know you're a legend.
You know, this record is just top to bottom, it's one of my favorite pop albums of the decade, and I think this song sort of encapsulates why, with its really just hookiness and smart lyrics and great playing all around.
It seems like, Maura, and I hate to crash your party here because you're calling this one of your favorite albums of the decade, but that these guys are sort of trying to be an alternative indie version of a boy band?
No, I don't think that at all. I think they're a really good rock band that's sort of in a weird place for bands that are rock but that have pop sensibilities. I mean, if you look at the rock charts right now, Alice in Chains, you know, who were one of the
Seattle grunge
bands, like, they're still topping the modern rock charts, and a lot of bands operating in that idiom are still controlling the rock charts. And, you know, it's just a weird sort of glitch of the system right now. Like, women sing pop and men do rock, and for any man to sort of bridge that gap on radio right now is a tough haul.
All right. Maybe I'll take a second listen. I want to ask you about another singer you brought for us. Her name is Fifi Dobson, and her song is called I Want You.
I want you when the sun comes up. I want to make you mine. I want to make it count. I want you. I want to take you home. I'm going to make it known. I want to take you on. I want you.
I love this song. This is a sort of a classic sort of jangly pop song. It's got all the elements of, you know, 60s, 70s, perfect pop songs. Who is she? Who's Fifi Dobson?
She is a Canadian singer. She had some minor successes earlier in the decade with some sort of Radio Disney teen pop leaning songs. And with this album, she's been releasing it on her own. And I actually heard this song. It was in ads on VH1. But this is the type of song, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, I think, about Fall Out Boy, is that, like, it's a tough sell for a melodic rock song sung by a woman, too. You know, because radio right now, I think, has been just super conservative in what it plays and what it doesn't. You hear a lot of similar sounds, and this just is an outlier. This would be something that, if radio stations did call out research on this song, which, you know, is how they determine what songs sort of make the cut on playlists, people might be confused by what's going on. But I think it's really fun. I mean, the thing I flash back to when I listen to it is American Bandstand. The
whole,
like, you
totally
know, it has a good beat and you can dance
totally
to it.
Yeah,
it's
totally
like an 83 or something for me.
Yeah. All right, Maura, we're going to save my favorite song for last. This is the song. I can't believe this song wasn't a bigger hit this year. It's called Delirious by the Vistoso Bosses.
The Vistoso Bosses.
Hey, over there, what's your name? Are you for real? Is this a game? You start to smile and I do the same. I look away, but you remain.
So, Maura, who are these singers? Who are the Vistoso Bosses?
So the Vistoso Bosses are two friends from Atlanta. They're 17 years old, and they are just these girls who are really into like hypercolor outfits and, you know, getting their nails done and singing really great songs about first crushes and love. And I think that this is their first single. It's on a label called Collie Park, which also has put out records by Soulja Boy. But I think that this song is just so wonderful. It's such like a small song about feelings and, you know, sort of like the small things that happen to somebody when they're first getting interested in someone else.
I start to laugh and you do the same. I look at you, you smile again.
And I just think their voices are so endearing. I mean, the first time I heard it, my heart like grew. You know?
Yeah.
It's just terrific.
It's such a sweet song.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
That's pop music critic Maura Johnston. Maura, I hope 2010 is a year when maybe you can finally escape the tyranny of the Black Eyed Peas.
I hope so.